and welcome to the Harrogate Health Show. Today I am joined by Tom Arundel, who has a company called Think Nourished. Thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me, Emily.
It's a pleasure. So tell us a little bit more about what it is that you do.
I think Nourish, yes. So I call myself a health and nutrition coach.
Nice.
I trained at the Institute of Integrative Nutrition as a holistic health coach. And I've subsequently done further training with a company called Precision Nutrition as a specifically a nutrition coach.
Okay.
So what I do is I help people install healthy habits in their lives.
Brilliant.
And I guess what I do is really informed by my background. So I'm 41 years old. I spent 17 years working in the corporate sector for a big, fast-moving consumer goods company called Procter & Gamble, who sell very well-known brands.
Everything.
Everything. Really. So everything from sort of washing powder, washing up liquid, shampoo, kinds of things that you find in the supermarket.
Okay.
So I spent a few years working down in a factory on IT systems before I moved up to Harrogate in 2004. And where I met my lovely wife, Lucy.
Lovely.
And moved into sales. Harrogate is a big regional sales office for Procter & Gamble. It turns over hundreds of millions of pounds through the office there. And I worked on what we call account teams. So I worked on the Asda team. I then worked on the Morrisons, Co-op, Wilkinson's team.
Okay.
A lot of fun. Sadly, around about 2011, I started getting ill. So a stress-related illness from work that led me to taking quite a bit of time off work.
Okay.
Then back into work, doing the same kind of thing, running at 100 miles an hour, by which time I had a family. My wife, Lucy, was at the time also at P&G as well, and she was working away about 3 days a week, and it all just got too much. And in 2016, I left P&G without really that much of a plan what I wanted to do. So I did some research. I knew I wanted to change in direction. I knew that I wanted to do something that would allow me to, I guess, help busy professionals in those stressful, high-octane jobs, and I discovered health coaching.
People who were living the kind of lifestyle that you'd been living.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. That had kind of led me to crash out of that world. So, okay. I mean, health coaching is really, really interesting. It's quite a new concept in the UK. It's been around in the US for a number of years.
Has it?
It has, yeah. And the Institute of Integrative Nutrition is based in New York,
right.
But it runs distance learning programs,
mm-hmm.
Which is the one that I enrolled on. And I think the central insight in health coaching is, it's predicated on the American healthcare model, which I think we all know about. It's highly privatized and very, very expensive. But there is very much in the States at the moment a healthcare crisis.
Okay.
I think you're seeing that mirrored around the world, but probably the States is at the forerunner of that. 70% of people are either overweight and obese in the States.
Wow.
I think it's 20-25% of people are either type 2 diabetic or pre-diabetic, and it's just going up and up and up and up. So, a vast proportion of all dollar healthcare spend in the US is spent on diabetes drugs. Predominantly,
wow.
I think it's called metformin, the drug. So health coaching came about from the insight that said, look, modern medicine is absolutely brilliant at curing, the diseases that led to high mortality rates over the last several hundred years. So TB,
yep.
These kind of diseases, but it's not yet got to a point where we can give people a pill that helps them overcome and reverse chronic what we'd probably call lifestyle diseases.
Okay.
So your type 2 diabetes, etc. We have medications that help people control that, but not really reverse it so much. So health coaching, or a health coach is basically somebody who works with their clients, and we call them clients as opposed to patients because we work subclinically with people. Anything that's a clinical condition, as health coaches, we're taught to refer out to the appropriate professionals.
Yes.
But we work with people on lifestyle changes. So
okay.
It may well be that somebody comes out of having seen their doctor or having had surgery, and they need to implement a strategy in their life that is going to help maintain or improve their health. So, I mean, clients for me could be very busy executives working in big businesses who are, I guess, frazzled.
Yep.
It could be people who come to me and say, look, I've let myself go a little bit over the years. I'm going to the gym, but I haven't quite found a way to lose weight yet. And I'd say probably the early clients I had very much had that as their as their pain point, if you like. Yeah.
Sort of that diet of coffee and donuts.
Exactly, exactly. And I think that we're told quite a lot of, or we're sold quite a lot of lies by the dietary industry.
You know, okay.
You can lose 2 stone in 2 weeks if you go on this diet. But you know, I think it's up to 95% of people, whenever they go on a diet, by which I define as a short-term modification in their eating behaviour,
yes,
will then rebound and then be on. And once you understand the science behind that and start explaining that to people, they kind of get it. So, you know, what I work with people on, and it's not just in the area of food, which we'll talk about, I think, a little bit later, but, you know, food is such a big thing.
Yes.
So it's like, how do I help people, or how do people help themselves even, you know, put in place a dietary strategy that is going to support weight loss goals and health goals over time? Because it's not just about weight loss, it's about overall health as well.
I feel like a GP told me once that the concept of breakfast... concept of breakfast was created by Kellogg's. Is that true?
I've actually heard the same thing as well.
Have you? Or is that another urban myth in itself?
Well, I don't know. It's certainly a myth out there. And there are various kind of aphorisms. I mean, I've heard one that says, you know, you breakfast like a king, you should lunch like a lord, and you should have dinner like a pauper.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, but I mean... It's probably one of the most commonly asked questions. People say, yeah, how important is it to have breakfast? Or should I be having 3 meals a day? Should I be having 5 smaller meals a day to keep the metabolic flame burning? That one was kind of, I think, you know, within the last 5-10 years or so, they've established that, you know, no, you don't have to eat 5 times a day.
Okay, good to know.
I would even say that 3 times a day is a personal choice. So very often I don't eat breakfast, and I'll have my first meal at 10, 11 o'clock. I don't particularly like eating a big meal in the morning.
Okay.
It just sits heavily on my stomach. So I say to people, look, do what feels right for you and what is sustainable for you. If you love your breakfast and you find that that gets you going in the morning, then great. I mean, we can work on what are the best kind of breakfast choices for people. It's probably not going to be a coffee and a donut.
Such a shame.
But there's a guy, Professor Walter Longo, who has a lab in, I think it's the University of San Francisco.
Wow.
In the States. He's certainly based in California, and he's also got a lab in Italy as well. And he's one of the foremost experts in longevity. So he talks about, he refers a lot to a concept called the Blue Zones.
Okay.
Now, the Blue Zones is awesome. The National Geographic, under a guy called Dan Buettner, set up a project which later became known as the Blue Zones. And I think they started work in the 1990s. And the question was basically this. Look, can we find out the areas in the world which have got massive longevity? And I think they defined that as, you know, the number of centenarians,
like
people living to 100, was something like 20 times the US average.
Gosh.
And so they set about these places, and they actually mark them on a map with a blue pen,
right,
which is why they're called blue zones.
Nice.
It's a fairly trivial reason for it.
Practical. I like it.
Yeah, but I think this was a decade-long research project. And Dan Buettner was actually one of the... he came and did a talk at the IAN Institute where I covered it. It was one of the best talks of the whole program. And so I guess the first thing was finding out... probably to start with, it would have been word of mouth and rumour.
Okay.
Where are these areas where we think people are really, or are well known for people living really, really long? And then let's get our research team go in and see if this is just an urban myth or whether there's data behind this.
Like the little Harrogates of the world.
Yes, exactly, exactly. the areas they identified were slightly bigger. So there are 5 blue zones throughout the world. There's a place called Nicoya in Costa Rica.
Nicoya.
There's Loma Linda, which is a community of Seventh-day Adventists just outside of Los Angeles.
Okay.
There's also Ikaria, which is an island in Greece. There is, I think it's not just Sardinia, I think it's the northern tip of Sardinia, which is a really kind of quite rustic...
Real old area. Italian.
Old Italian.
Traditional.
Predominantly shepherd community. So they eat very dark bread, they drink very dark red wine, and they eat sheep's cheese as their kind of main meals.
Wow.
And there's also Okinawa in Japan, which is probably the most famous of them. There was a book written in the 90s called The Okinawa Way, because the Okinawans were very, very famous for their longevity. I think they are the longest lived population in the whole world. Or they were before a US Army base was established close to Okinawa after the Second World War. And the next generation of Okinawans were not living as long because they were resorting more to the kind of American junk food based diet.
Goodness, okay.
Yeah. So that's one where people say, oh, is it purely genetics? It's like, well, actually, no, we've got a great population that we can look at in Okinawa that says, you know, the ancestors live long lives, in a very high degree, living well into their hundreds, but also living very active and mobile lives well into their hundreds as well.
Keeping that quality of life.
So to come back to Dan Boutner and the National Geographic and the Blue Zones project, so they looked at what are the commonalities in all of these populations, and you know, I guess diet was one of them. One of the key ones, but also lifestyle as well. But I mean, the key components of the diet were, you know, relatively low in meat and fish.
Okay.
The only vegetarians were the Loma Linda Seventh-day Adventists. Almost entirely unrefined, unprocessed, you know, whole foods,
foods that
your grandmother would recognise as food rather than food out of a packet. Pretty high in pulses.
Okay.
Most of them were pretty high in pulses, or in the case of Okinawa, you'd associate Okinawa with a diet high in rice.
Okay.
Not true. They ate a little bit of rice in Okinawa, but the staple food, I think it was up to 70% of their diet, was actually a purple sweet potato.
Wow.
But pretty
not
high.
Not what I would have guessed.
No, exactly. And it's almost counterintuitive, but then they have stuff like, I think it's umeboshi, which is a sort of pickled plum. But you know, diet was only one of the ingredients in this long and successful life. All of them were pretty active, albeit they weren't kind of CrossFitters. But they were, you know, they'd tend their gardens, they'd live active lives. Very strong sense of community and family. Very strong sense of purpose as well. So all of these kind of areas are things that we incorporate into health coaching. The other interesting one as well was that almost, and again with the exception of Loma Linda, the other four areas did drink alcohol.
Okay.
There's nobody in the world of nutrition that says that alcohol is good for you because the body treats it as a poison, and it can kind of clog the liver with regards to the digestive system, but a small amount seems to have a beneficial effect in these populations.
So to live the longest, we need to eat well. What does eat well mean?
To me, eat well means, I think, eating a diet that is rich in fruit and vegetables.
Okay.
Rich in unprocessed foods, you know, real foods, not foods out of a packet. And I think eating consistently, eating sustainably, the area of diet is I think something where it probably sees more fads than anything else, whether it's kind of, you know, low carb, high carb, low fat, high fat, keto, the every other day diet, the red green diet. There's, almost as many diet books out there as there are people in the world, I think. But I think when you have a look at the areas of the world that have the best health outcomes, okay, there may not be any single ingredient. I think too often we do focus on, you know, superfoods or single ingredients. It's
yes.
Nutrient-dense foods. It's minimally processed foods. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, any level of processing in food is a bad thing at all. A, because unrealistic, and B, because, you know, tin sardines, great food, but it's processed. It's in a tin.
True.
Tin tomatoes, you know, absolutely brilliant. Frozen peas, actually fresher and locks in probably more the nutrients than older peas because they're frozen at the point of being picked. That's a processed food. That's really healthy food stuff. And my two little girls, they have at least two or three portions of peas every single week. They love them.
Now, I read a book called The Friendship Cure, and that talked about some groups of people who lived longer and what you were touching on with the idea of community.
Yeah.
Health, coaching and community. How does that go hand in hand?
How does that go hand in hand? Well, I haven't read The Friendship Cure myself. I may have heard of it.
In a nutshell, it was about different types of friendships.
Yeah.
and generally about having people around you keeping you cognitively active,
yeah,
and looking at these populations and thinking, actually, say, take the people on in Sardinia, it was the extended family groups,
yeah,
and having the communication and the support and the love and the nurture, yeah, and that sense of maybe not necessarily purpose, but that sense of being.
Yes.
That
and
sense
belonging
of
as well, belonging, I guess, yeah.
Yes, that being valued.
Yeah.
Because that's something in the digital age that we've maybe changed.
Yeah. And so I think you're bang on to come back to your question, which was, you know, how does that work in health coaching? And I've talked about, you know, diet and nutrition as being a key area. But I did have a client reasonably recently, and one of the action points that she agreed that she'd do was she'd see her friends more. So we had a strategy whereby, and it feels almost cynical to call it a friendship strategy, but mm-hmm. She's self-employed, you know, very successful, runs her own business, and realised that she just wasn't seeing her friends all that much. So she committed to booking in, you know, a couple of sessions a week where she'd go and see her friends. And she said, along with some work we did on her sleep, it was the most beneficial thing for her in the life cycle of our coaching process.
Talk about sleep then, because sleep affects different people differently, doesn't it? I'm nothing without sleep. 8 hours, less than 8 hours, and but it affects different people differently. What sort of work do you do around sleep?
So I was really fortunate in that about 3 or 4 months ago, I went and worked a corporate job for Biffa Waste Management.
Oh,
so you'll
okay.
have seen the Biffa bins everywhere. And I,
yeah, they're huge.
Yeah, they are. They are. Strangely enough, my dad's a childhood friend with the Biffa family.
Oh, really?
So when I went back in, it was kind of quite fun to see. And they're based just down the road from where I grew up in Buckinghamshire.
Okay.
But I was asked to go in and do some nutrition workshops at Biffa. And I ran, I think it was the same workshop about 10 times over. It was a 15-20 minute workshop. And my remit was, look, make it fun, make it punchy, and give people practical advice for improving their dietary habits,
okay,
given that a lot of these people are on the road a lot of the time. So I did some juicing demos, I did some smoothie demos, yes, and along with one of my business partners in this, she'd made some protein balls as well. She's a personal trainer and also a health coach as well, and her kind of go-to snack is a protein ball.
Mm-hmm.
Can't even remember how she makes it, but I think, yeah, there's probably some chopped up coconut, some cocoa, and you sort of roll it up into a ball that you can just pop in your mouth at the end of or either before and after a personal training session.
Fantastic.
A workout. So I was doing this nutrition workshop, and I was presenting alongside a lady, and I'll get her name wrong because it's quite complicated, but I think her name is Dr. Charlotte Ellsworth Edelstein, who is a world-renowned sleep researcher. She's got a laboratory in Geneva and lives out in France in the mountains. You know, just amazing lifestyle. And so I got to listen to her talk about sleep. And I think that you said, you know, sleep is different for different people. I think that it's almost like the foundation of everything in health.
Okay.
Sleep is incredibly important. There's several books come out quite recently. There's a guy who, again, he's a British guy based in California called Dr. Matthew Walker, who's written probably the best general audience book on sleep, called Why We Sleep.
Okay.
It's awesome.
Worth a read.
Worth a read. I'll lend you my coffee if you'd like, Emily.
Thank you.
but he's superb. He's appeared on a lot of big podcasts. Not yet the Harrogate Health Show.
Maybe one day
you can get him on. And he's, you know, just exceptionally charismatic, exceptionally articulate. But sleep is, people have realised over the last few years, sleep is so important. If there's a myth out there in the general population, it's, oh, some people don't need much sleep, or I'll just cut back on my sleep. Cutting back on sleep has or can have catastrophic consequences for your health. So
okay.
Dr. Charlotte, who I was presenting alongside, talked about Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan. She said, you know, they were both famous throughout the 80s for existing on, you know, 3-4 hours sleep a night. Both of them then had, I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was either vascular dementia,
yes,
or Alzheimer's or something like that.
Different types of cognitive decline, but
yes,
significant cognitive decline.
A significant cognitive decline, almost certainly linked to chronic sleep deprivation over time.
Wow.
So you get the long-term consequences of lack of sleep, but you also get the short-term consequences. So okay. There have been various research done in the military where people are sleep deprived. And the go-to test for any kind of sleep doctor is something called the Stroop test.
Okay.
So the Stroop test, you won't have heard of it, but when I describe it to you, I think you'll understand what I mean. So have you ever seen those things where you have the word green written in yellow?
Yes.
The word red written in blue, and you have to say, I can't remember which way around it is, whether it's you've got to say the colour or you've got to say the word. I think you've
the
got
word.
To say the word, haven't
it's
you?
The word, yeah.
And it's hard to do, but they can... Dr. Charlotte runs this with people, and she can basically say this is how sleep deprived you are based on how you perform on the Stroop test.
Oh, goodness me.
So you not only see long-term cognitive decline impairment, you see short-term...
Decision-making,
reactions, and cognitive decline.
Wow.
Based on lack of sleep.
Okay.
So sleep is enormously important. And how I integrate that into health coaching, I mean, a lot of people I see say, look, I'm struggling to sleep. Now, again, if it's a clear case of they've got clinical insomnia, then I would need to refer them out. Probably first point would be GP, given there aren't many sleep doctor specialists around.
Okay.
Dr. Charlotte's based in Geneva. But there are several things that you can do to improve your sleep. And I think we were going to talk about, you know, Tom's top health tips. And I would say, you know, sleep is, get good sleep is number one.
Number one.
There's various ways you can do that. And there's various factors which will prevent people from sleeping if we're not talking about, you know, a serious case of insomnia. So we run on, and all of us, and I think it's all, pretty much every single living being runs on what's called a circadian rhythm.
Yes.
So this is for humans, it's not quite, but it's roughly a 24-hour internal body clock. Most of the cells in our body have got this circadian clock.
Wow.
And it basically regulates us. Now, sleep, going to sleep resets your circadian clock, but maintaining your circadian rhythm is incredibly important in maintaining your overall health. And if you get knocked out of it, so jet lag is a classic example of when people get knocked out of their circadian rhythm, because your body thinks it's one time, and yet the clocks and life in a different time zone are telling you something else. So my wife Lucy's just got back from Thailand, where there's a 7-hour time difference. She landed back on Monday. She was at a wedding out there. It'll take her probably one day for every hour that she's out, so she probably won't be back on her normal clock for until after the weekend.
Okay.
So that's how long it can take. So resetting your circadian rhythm is really important. If you think of your whole day as preparing you for sleep,
mm-hmm.
there are, you know, three or four kind of tips I'd give. Number one is get 30 minutes of ideally outside light in the morning. So whether that's on your commute, if you walk somewhere, or one of my clients, we worked out that she drove into work and she didn't have a way of getting outside, but she was on the phone a lot. So she then said, right, what I'll do is I'll take a lot of my calls outside. So I will get that sunlight exposure. Because the different, I guess photographers will know this, when they're using their cameras and they see sort of shutter speed, you know, dramatically increase when you go inside. But our eyes automatically adjust for the lack of light inside. But the difference between, you know, we're sat in a room and we can see out the window, Emily.
Yes.
If we just move to the outside of that window, there would be a huge increase in the amount of light coming into our eyes. So
getting natural
light exposure, particularly in winter when there's not as much sun, is really, really important.
Okay.
Coffee is another big one.
Okay. So, tip, we should have more coffee?
Well, some of us, and I mean, it's quite an individual thing, have an enzyme in the liver that processes coffee exceptionally quickly.
Wow.
Some of us don't. Going back to the blue zones, the Icarians in Greece are thought to have this enzyme, because a lot of them will have, you know, 6 or 7 cups of very strong coffee in the morning, and it doesn't interrupt their sleep in any way.
Okay.
But the interesting thing about caffeine, so pretty much from the point that we wake up, and, you know, Dr. Matthew Walker in his book Why We Sleep talks a lot in a lot more detail that I'm able to about this, but we produce I think it's a neurotransmitter called adenosine, which they think is actually a kind of like a waste product, and it accumulates over the day. And towards the end of the day, it then binds to certain receptors in our brain, which then makes us fall asleep. And then as part of the sleep cycle, you clear out the adenosine, you wow. wake up and it all starts again. But caffeine and adenosine compete for the same neuroreceptors. So if caffeine has bound itself, and caffeine's got, it's got, I think it's a quarter life of about 12 hours or so.
Right.
So, you know, if you're having a coffee at 8, 9 o'clock in the morning, you're most of the way gone by the time you're going to bed. But if you're sort of drinking coffee all the way through the afternoon, and you're not, and you're one of those people who doesn't metabolize coffee particularly effectively, you know, that's bound to all the receptors in your brain, which adenosine wants to bind to help you go to sleep. And so it then makes it very difficult, you know, for people with a lot of caffeine in their system to fall asleep, which is why it's so effective when you're doing those late night essays at university and having yeah. those kind of work crises. And then, I mean, coming back to the whole circadian rhythm and light, at the other end of the day, what we want to do is we want to make it as dark as possible. You'll have seen, if you've got an iPhone, that's now got one of these blue light filters.
Okay, yeah.
So it is blue light that keeps us awake. If we're able to block out the blue light by means of a filter on our phones or screens, you can get these really funky glasses, which have got red light filters, which I have as well.
Do you?
Yeah, I do. And I also go to sleep with a sleep mask on as well, which blocks out light as well. So all of these really, really help me. There's also a lot of wearable tech as well that helps you have a look at how you're sleeping. So I have, well, this looks like just a funky ring.
Yeah.
But actually, if you look on the inside, it's got a whole load of circuitry.
Oh, gosh, so it does.
Yeah, so it's not as intrusive as a watch. It's it's supposed to be the best tech out there for tracking sleep at the moment. So in the morning, I upload it to my phone, and it tells me all about my sleep cycle. So you have people know about REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep, but you actually have about five different types of sleep. You've got four different types of non-REM sleep, and then you've got one... then you've got REM sleep. So non-REM, sort of, you know, stage one all the way down to, I think it's stage four, very, very deep sleep. But REM is where you dream. But the deep stages of REM sleep, of non-REM sleep, sorry, that you want to get to, that's where your body does a lot of its processing, repair work, and kind of recharge for the next day.
Incredible.
Yeah.
So thinking about everything we've spoken about, what would be your three top tips?
Okay, so number one, without a doubt, is sleep. Without sleep, we're just not going to function at all. And actually, when we're sleep deprived, that makes changing any dietary habits really difficult. Really difficult. I think number two, and it took me a long time to realise this. So I was very active when I was at school. I played a lot of cricket, a lot of golf. And then once I, pretty much when I went to university, actually, I didn't do very much exercise for probably 15 years or so.
Okay.
Exercise is hugely important. It's part of the weight loss puzzle for people who are looking to lose weight. It's probably not as important as diet. And actually, kind of, I've always found that whenever I talk to personal trainers, the kind of their dirty secret almost is that diet is far more important than exercise. But exercise is important for so many different reasons. And okay. actually, it can be a great way to get outside. And we talked earlier about the importance of daylight in sleep. But yeah, exercise is very, very important. I'm not a personal trainer myself. I work with a personal trainer because I need that accountability to actually go and do exercise myself. But the most important thing is you have to enjoy what you're doing, or you have to, I guess, have an accountability coach who will make you move yourself in the gym.
Okay.
And then I think the third one, and I'm going to use a quote from a US food journalist called Michael Pollan. And people say to me, what's the best diet? Is it keto? Is it low carb? And he said, eat food, not too much, mostly plants.
Okay.
Which I love. It's just really, really simple. So, you know, a diet that's, I've used the phrase before, you know, minimally processed, whole foods. So brown rice will generally be better than white rice. You metabolize it slower. It's got more nutrients because it hasn't had the, I think it's the husk and the endosperm gets stripped out of brown rice when it becomes white rice, correct.
Mm.
And yeah, I mean, I love meat, but I think, and I love fish as well. If you're going to follow a vegan diet, vegans will very often see certain deficiencies. So vitamin B12 is a really big one.
Okay.
So you know, I've got a friend of mine actually who's he works in the city and he's just found veganism. There's a quite famous documentary that's just hit on Netflix called Game Changers, which is kind of making everybody reappraise it. But I said to him, one of the things you do need to do is get your blood checked, make sure that you don't have any mineral deficiencies, and almost certainly you'll want to supplement with vitamin B12.
B12, yeah. Nice.
So yeah, ooh. Sleep, exercise, and yeah, the importance of, I guess, home-cooked, minimally processed food.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. I feel like I've learned so much there. I really do. I really do. I hope there's lots of interesting things for people to get their teeth into. So if people wanted to find out a bit more about you and the work that you're doing, can you tell us website, how to get in touch with you, things like that?
So probably the best way is just to email me. So I'm tom@thinknourished.com.
Perfect. Well, thanks again.
Thank you for having me, Ellie.
The Harrogate Health Show is proudly sponsored by The Hearing Suite.